From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a blues concert with Sapphire, the uppity blues women. The group was founded by two middle-aged women who gave up their day jobs to play the music they loved full-time. They've just released their fourth album. Also today, how football players are changed by money and fame. We talk with Mark Bowden. His new book, Bringing the Heat, is about the Philadelphia Eagles. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Definitely Maybe, the debut album by Oasis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A federal appeals court has temporarily lifted a court ban on the repatriation of Cubans from refugee camps. The appeals court must now decide if the Cubans and Haitian refugees have constitutional rights, like access to lawyers. Meanwhile, a second lawsuit filed by advocates for Haitian refugees argues Haitian and Cuban refugees aren't being treated equally. They point to some Cuban children who are being allowed into the United States. Hundreds of Mexican army troops are reported to be moving toward a town in the southern Mexican state of Chiapas, where armed rebels yesterday seized a town hall and looted stores. NPR's David Wellner reports from Mexico City.
Tanks, jeeps mounted with heavy machine guns, and truckloads of Mexican army soldiers were spotted today on their way to the town of Cimahuvil in the north of Chiapas. The city's town hall was seized yesterday by dozens of armed rebels wearing uniforms similar to those of the Zapatistas, who first rose up a year ago. The mayor of Cimahuvil told a Mexico City radio station today that his town council had requested help from the army and that it appeared to be on the way. The mayor said the rebels had burned documents in the town hall and looted several local stores. At the National Congress here in Mexico City, an army general told legislators today that the army is ready to use force in Chiapas and is only awaiting orders from Mexican President Ernesto Zedillo. Zedillo has said he won't resort to violence in Chiapas. I'm David Wellner in Mexico City.
Czech authorities have confirmed 6 pounds of uranium they seized yesterday in Prague are weapons-grade material. This is the world's largest seizure of weapons-quality nuclear material. Peter Green reports from Prague.
The Czech Interior Ministry said today the case, 6 pounds of highly enriched uranium-235, was indeed weapons-grade material, about an eighth of the amount needed to make an atomic bomb. A Czech official said the seizure was unparalleled. Officials at the International Atomic Energy Agency said the uranium could have come from either a weapons factory or the reactor of a nuclear submarine. Russian-language documents found with the uranium suggest it came from the former Soviet Union, but police said laboratory analysis would determine its origin. Authorities say the uranium's quality was a little lower than that preferred by bomb makers, but could have been used as the trigger for a thermonuclear bomb. For National Public Radio, I'm Peter Green in Prague.
U.S. Park Police say the man they shot in front of the White House this morning will survive. Officers shot Marcelina Corniel, a homeless man who lived in Lafayette Park across from the White House. He'd been ordered to drop a large hunting knife he'd threatened officers with. A Park Police spokesman says Corniel had the knife taped to his hand. Another witness says Corniel threatened police this morning after they woke him up in the park. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 20 points. This is NPR News. The Federal Reserve has ended its policymaking session today without increasing interest rates. The decision to let the rates alone had been expected. The central bank had just boosted rates 5 weeks ago at its last meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee. Many analysts, however, say they expect the Fed to raise rates again sooner rather than later. A national survey released today by the New York City Gay and Lesbian Anti-Violence Project concludes most murders of gays and lesbians are brutal. The survey also finds many of the murders go unsolved. NPR's Margot Adler reports from New York.
The Anti-Violence Project looked at 151 murders of gays in 29 states during the past 3 years. They said 60% of the murders were fueled by rage and hate and involved what law enforcement agencies call overkill. These murders were characterized by dismemberment, stabbing, and mutilation. In 24 of the incidents, the victim was stabbed more than 12 times. Only 26% of the homicides were simple deaths by firearms, whereas in general, 70% of U.S. homicides are by firearms. The report also said that only 51% of the homicides had been solved, well below the national average of 65%. The Anti-Violence Project attributed the low resolution rate to a lack of concern on the part of local law enforcement. I'm Margo Adler in New York.
National Security Advisor Anthony Lake has told Angola's president and a rebel leader that the present ceasefire could be the country's last chance for peace. Both sides in the Angolan war accuse each other of violating the ceasefire that was signed in Zambia last month to end the 19-year-old civil war. The Italian deputy prime minister says Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi will resign tomorrow and press for new elections. That report hasn't been confirmed, and Berlusconi's spokesman says the premier is keeping all his options open. Berlusconi faces a no-confidence motion tomorrow in the Italian parliament. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Everyone sings about a white Christmas, but if, like Elvis, you're expecting a Christmas that's blue, you're in the spirit for our blues concert featuring Sapphire, the Uppity Blues Women. The group was founded by pianist and singer Ann Rapson and singer-guitarist Gaya Degbolola. They were already in their 40s 5 years ago when they quit their jobs to play music full-time. Ann had worked as a computer programmer. Gay was a teacher who had won the Virginia Teacher of the Year Award in 1982. Sapphire's repertoire features classic blues, as well as original songs on such classic subjects as sex and love, not to mention subjects Bessie Smith never sang about, like a visit to the gynecologist's office. On their new album, Old New, Borrowed and Blue, the women pay tribute to their musical influences. Joining us along with the group's founding members is Andra Faye McIntosh, who we'll hear on bass. I want to welcome you all to Fresh Air. Thank you for coming. And Gay, I'm going to ask you to introduce the first song for us.
Great. This is a song that Bessie Smith did, Billie Holiday did, and recently Rory Block did it. And this is our version, which is slowed down a bit, and it's called Do Your Duty. Three times a day, baby, calm and drive my blues away. And when you come, be ready to play. Do your duty. If you want to have some luck, give your spot. Give me all
service you got. Do around my house and pout. If you do, you'll catch me tipping out. Do your duty. If you make your own bed hard, that's the way it lies. And if I'm tired of sleeping by myself, you're too dumb to realize. Oh, baby, I ain't trying to make you feel blue. I ain't satisfied with the things that you do. I'm just trying to find somebody to
That's Sapphire, and singing was Gay Adegbolola, and raps and at the piano, Andra Faye McIntosh on bass. What a great song.
Thank you.
Anne, you were performing since you were a teenager.
Right. I had my first paying gig when I was still in high school, playing blues, playing guitar, though. I didn't start playing piano really until I was 35.
Now, that's hard for me to understand because I think you're a really fine pianist.
Well,
and
thank you.
I think it's a very difficult instrument to start late, so it's hard for me to believe you didn't play it until then.
I think, I guess maybe it's just my instrument. I think maybe everybody has an instrument, and I was just lucky that I found mine.
Now, your new album features mostly blues songs that were first recorded by performers who were influential to members of Sapphire.
Oh, yes.
Right.
So let me ask you to do another song that you also recorded on the new album. It's called The Clock.
Yes.
And Gay, you sing this one, and it was originally recorded by Johnny Ace.
Yes.
Tell us why. Tell us what this song did to you when you...
It's real funny. When you said that, I just goosebumped all over. I don't know. It's real special to me. Again, this goes back to when I was growing up, and my mom ran the youth canteen in Fredericksburg, Virginia. I was born, raised, and still live in Fredericksburg. And every 6 months or so, the records would get changed on the jukebox. It was a real jukebox. She would bring those old 78s home. I would play them over and over, and my favorite singer was Johnny Ace.
Now, our listeners will probably know him from the record Pledging My Love. Sing a couple
yes.
of lines of that so our listeners remember.
Pledging My Love?
Yeah.
Forever, my darling, I'll love only you, always and forever, our love will be true. And little Milton Campbell just recorded that. But I think most listeners right now today, Luther Vandross just covered what was perhaps Johnny Ace's biggest hit, which was Never Let Me Go.
But The Clock, was that a B-side or is that one of his hits?
For me, it was one of his hits. I don't know if it was A or B or not, but I heard it, and it's so simple. It's so simple in terms of the lyrics and in terms of the musical part, and it's so lonely. It's so lonely. I was saying to an audience the other night, well, I actually kind of picture my mom, who's 81, and I know she spends a lot of time just sitting, and I think old folks in particular sit a lot, and they think about the good old days, and with that goes persons that they've lost and loves that they've lost. So it's not just when I sing it, I don't just sing it for the heartbroken. I have all kinds of images in my head. I think another little piece of the story that's interesting is that Johnny Ace supposedly killed himself playing Russian roulette in 1954 in Houston. And the audience was waiting for him to come on. And he was backstage, and they heard the shot, you know.
Well, why don't you sing it for us?
Okay.
I looked at the face of the clock on the wall.
doesn't tell me nothing at all. That face on the clock, it just stares at me. It knows that I'm lonely, and I always will be. I wanna cry my heart out. I want my baby back with me. I've got nothing but time fool around, but time means nothing to me. If you hear me, please come back real soon, 'cause this clock and I are so lonely in this room. Time to fool around, but time means nothing to me. If you hear me, please come back real soon, 'cause this clock and I are so lonely in this room. I looked at the face of the clock on the wall. Doesn't tell me nothing at all. That face on the clock, it just stares at me. It knows and I always will be.
That's Sapphire of the Uppity Blues Women. We heard Gaye Adegbolola singing with Ann Rapson piano, Andra Faye McIntosh bass. Sapphire has a new CD called Old, New, Borrowed, and Blue. They'll perform some more songs for us after we take a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Sapphire of the Uppity Blues Women. I'm wondering what it was like for you before Sapphire, when you were each when you had very time-consuming jobs. I mean, Anne, you were, what, a computer programmer for a long time? Do I have that right?
Yeah, I there was a period of time in my life when I had a day job as a computer programmer. That's true. And
And you were performing at night?
I was performing at night. But there was a much larger period of time in my life when I was performing full-time.
Oh.
But again, it's a much more interesting story. I figured it out. There was somewhere between 6 and 10 years there where I had a day job, and it was, I will never do that again. Pantyhose will never touch those legs again. I will never take a day job again. But at the time, I had to stay in one place. You sort of have to move around to make a living playing music unless you live someplace really that I wouldn't want to live. So raising a child, you don't want to leave them and go off too much, so... You take a day job, and putting a kid through college is, of course, Gay. Now, Gay did it from
playing music.
So,
yeah.
What's the difference playing at a bar or playing at an audience where a lot of women who've shown up are hearing that, you know, this is a band of women and they sing some feminist-oriented materials?
They usually walk out.
Do they?
Uh-huh. No, I'm serious, because we are all women, and we are all very diverse. Women. And if people consider any particular politics or any particular, although our politics actually are kind of similar, but anyway, we don't, you know, we try to sing to everybody, and that includes all women. And we represent very nearly all women.
Yeah, and Ed is kind of tiptoeing around, but I think a lot of times with predominantly lesbian audiences, sometimes we're really put down because we do sing a lot about my man, my man. But we sing about everything, and I think we can upset anybody if we want to. You know?
Well, you have your share of double entendre songs.
Oh, yes.
And yeah. So I must call on you now to do one. And why don't we feature your singing on this song?
All right. I wrote this song, actually. I wrote it about I had this big old tore-up tomcat. Big old yellow tomcat. I know you know the type. And also, I also wrote it about a bass player I used to know. And it's called Tomcat Blues. My baby's a big old tomcat, a rough, tough, nasty stray. Tough old tomcat, a rough, tough, nasty stray. Well, at night he's chasing mice, and he lays around sleeping all day. Well, he's a rough old tomcat, he's all chewed up and scarred. Well, he's a rough old tomcat, he's all chewed up and scarred. Bottoms of my shoes. When he rubs up against me, I don't know what to say. I'm just his little kitten, and he always gets his way. My baby's a tough old tomcat, lands on his feet when he falls. Well, he's a tough old tomcat, lands on his feet when he falls. Up against me, I don't know what to say. I'm just this little kitten, and he, oh.
gets his way. My baby's a tough old tomcat, lands on his feet when he falls. Well, he's a rough old tomcat, lands on his feet when he falls. Then he lays out in the sunshine, purring and licking his paws. Then he lays out in the sunshine, purring and licking his paws.
We're listening to Sapphire, and that was Anne Rapson, piano and vocals, and she wrote the song. Gay Adigbolola, who was featured on guitar with Andra Faye McIntosh on bass. Anne, what musically went into that? Were you thinking of other pianists or of songwriters when you wrote that?
It's really funny. There's all kinds of history to this one. I originally wrote it with a harmonica player named Lazy Lester in mind, hoping he would sing it.
Mm-hmm.
Written from the man's point of view, but then I liked it and I took it myself. But the piano line, this... That thing actually comes from a fellow named Big Maceo Merriweather, only it was a very different feeling. It was... Oh, Lordy Lord. Oh, Lordy Lord. Hurt me so bad. For us to part, I can't get that low. But someday, baby, ain't gonna worry my life anymore. That's where that comes from.
Gay, I'm interested in hearing what your life was like before Sapphire. Now, I know you were a teacher. I think you taught eighth grade science.
You got
the Virginia Teachers of the Year Award one year.
Yeah.
So did you sing at all during that period?
Anne taught me in 75, 76, something like that, and around in there, and I started doing solo work, moonlighting. I'd gotten to a point, I raised my son alone, and I really needed some other income. So either I had to have the nerve to take it to the bar and earn it there, or either I was going to seek out McDonald's or someplace. So I started moonlighting three nights a week, and I did that for several years while teaching eighth grade mainly. And then in 84 is when I got a call for a bigger room and asked Ann to come on, let's do it, because we had been doing duo things for a while. And we added in local bass player Earlene Lewis. And Earl left about 2.5 years ago. So I was doing that simultaneously in 1988. This is where you get the 88 from. Ann's daughter was graduating from college, and Ann said, the day she graduates is the day I'm going back to music full time, and I'm going to do it, and do you want to come? So my son was just going into college, but I had money saved for a year. And I put in for a year's leave of absence, and... it just grew.
It's been a pleasure having you here and a delight to hear you play. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
For being
us.
With us.
Yeah.
Really
Thank
enjoyed
you.
It.
Thank you.
And Sapphire does have a new record. It's called Old New Borrowed in Blue. It's on Alligator Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Anne, would you play us out?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the heady world of pro football. We talk with Mark Bowden about the impact of fame and fortune on the lives of the players. His new book, Bringing the Heat, is about the Philadelphia Eagles. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the debut album by Oasis, a band that's already become a hit in England. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A homeless man who ran across the street toward the White House with a knife was shot twice by police today. He had ignored orders to stop. This witness was in front of the White House when the incident happened.
I heard two screams, looked down the walkway here, saw this guy in a brown jacket having a little tiny scuffle with a security officer. At that time, they broke apart. The man in a brown jacket had his hand outstretched, kind of chased the security officer around for a couple seconds. Then he stopped. More security men came. He stood motionless. They told him to put down whatever he had in his hand, apparently, and he didn't, and two shots were fired.
The shot man is expected to survive. President Clinton was in the Oval Office when the incident occurred. He was never in danger. This is the third shooting incident at or near the president's residence in 2 months. Reports from Mexico indicate 1,000 Mexican police and soldiers have moved into Chiapas State today. The Zapatista Rebel Army says its truce with the Mexican government is over. More than 36 towns have been seized by armed peasants thought to be linked to the rebel movement. The rebels are upset with the recent inauguration of Chiapas' new government. They say the new leader won his state election fraudulently. The German government has agreed that German forces can be used for military missions in Bosnia. This is the first time since World War II the Bonn government has agreed to the use of German troops outside of Allied territory. NPR's Deidre Berger reports.
The German cabinet has agreed to send Tornado fighter jets to Bosnia in the case of a pullout of United Nations peacekeeping forces. Chancellor Friedrich Bohl says Germany is also prepared to offer cargo planes, minesweepers, and ships. Earlier this month, German leaders said Bonn would at least offer logistical support and medical personnel. A NATO request for Tornado jets to provide air cover in the event of a UN withdrawal has created political controversy. A recent court ruling opened the way for Germany to participate in UN peacekeeping missions, but many opposition leaders reject German military intervention in the Bosnian conflict for historical reasons, arguing such help will escalate hostilities. The cabinet's okay on German fighter jets must be approved by Parliament before troops can be sent to Bosnia. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Intel Corporation has changed its mind. The firm says it will now replace flawed Pentium computer chips for anybody who wants a new one without asking any questions. Intel had previously required owners to show that the computer work they did would be affected by the computer chip. Intel continues to point out its chip can cause errors only in rare cases. The firm's president says the technical problem had taken on a life of its own. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today in unofficial results. The Dow lost 23 points. This is NPR. A major anti-smoking group wants the Food and Drug Administration to classify a new smokeless cigarette as a drug. The cigarette is being developed by R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
A legal complaint filed by the group Action on Smoking and Health contends that the new smokeless cigarette delivers as much tar and nicotine as existing cigarettes and provides little, if any, health advantage. The group wants the FDA to regulate the new cigarette as a drug. The agency is currently considering a plan to classify ordinary cigarettes as drugs. The anti-smoking group is asking the agency to treat the new product the same as other devices for administering nicotine to users, such as chewing gums and patches. The group says the FDA should follow a 1987 ruling that smokeless cigarettes were an alternative nicotine delivery system intended to satisfy nicotine dependence. R.J. Reynolds, a subsidiary of the RJR Nabisco Corporation, has dismissed reports that it will soon market a new reduced smoke cigarette. The company says the reports are premature and that the product will not be sold until it tastes as good as other cigarettes. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
The maker of Barbie dolls and Hot Wheels is going to cut 1,000 jobs. Mattel Corporation says it'll consolidate its manufacturing and slice the executive payroll. The toy maker is expecting a sixth straight year of record profits and sales. Mattel's 1994 earnings will be reduced $70 million to pay for this restructuring. U.S. officials have met with North Korean officials on two U.S. Army helicopter pilots. A military spokesman didn't give much detail, but he says the North has accepted a formal U.N. request for the immediate return of Chief Warrant Officer Bobby Hall and the body of his crewmate David Heilemann. They have been held by the North Koreans since Saturday. Meanwhile, a South Korean paper is commenting on the lack of anti-American rhetoric from the North. The paper says this is a change in the North's usual practice. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Philadelphia is not proud of its football team, the Eagles. In the Philadelphia Inquirer today, the team was called the most pathetic creature there is in sports. After this losing season, the team is expected to say goodbye to its coach, Rich Kotite, and quarterback, Randall Cunningham. My guest, Mark Bowden, is the author of a new book about the Eagles called Bringing the Heat. He's a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer who covered sports for 3 years. But he doesn't think of himself as a conventional sports writer. He spent the 1992 season with the Eagles looking for the stories that didn't typically make it to the sports pages about the subculture of football. And he wanted to write the kind of literary book that's more associated with baseball and basketball than football. He says that most sports pages focus on players as performers, not as people.
I was really curious to know who these guys are, where they come from, and how they make it to the professional level, and then what happens to their lives when they achieve this sudden level of success, money, and celebrity at a very young age. I wanted to know how that affected them, how it affected their heads, how it affected their lives. So I set out to do that.
Football players are living out a lot of people's fantasy. The fantasy being that you've got a talent, you get recognized for it, and in return for that recognition, you get fame and you get money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how did the people you wrote about handle the fame and the money, those who had both?
I think that I think one of the fascinating aspects of professional sports is that it's the modern example of the fantasy of getting rich quick, which I think is really close to the core of American spirit, or of one of the things that excites all of us. And we get to watch what happens to these guys. Most of them, surprisingly, handle it really well, I thought. They're level-headed, and they invest their money, and they plan for the future. A lot of them don't handle it well at all, and it has an effect on them in a whole variety of ways. One of the things that happened that was surprising to me was the extent to which some these young players would become completely isolated from their families and from their communities. I'm thinking particularly of Ben Smith, who was a 1990 number one draft pick by the Eagles. And Ben grew up in southern Georgia in a very large extended family in very poor conditions. Ben told me that he actually had never slept on a bed until he was 13 or 14 years old. He was passed around from aunts and uncles. His parents had split up. He had a whole slew of stepbrothers and stepsisters and cousins and siblings and uncles and aunts. And when he made it into professional football and signed his, and got his million-dollar payday, I call it, what happened to Ben was he was cut off from his family and from his community because everybody wanted something from him. There was such a tremendous disparity between where he had come from and the people who he knew then and what he had now, that it became impossible for him to bridge it. He built himself a house in a suburb over in New Jersey, and you would find him even in the off season living there by himself. His parents were feuding because his father felt like he'd given more money to his mother than he'd given to him. If he went home for a visit, he'd have old teammates and relatives coming up asking him for $500, asking him for money to pay off the mortgage of their house, bringing up old favors that they had done to him at one point. Ben told me that in many ways he was happier when he didn't have a penny to his name and he was playing college football and he had to bum money to go buy pizza because he just didn't have all these other issues weighing on him constantly. So I found that to be one of the surprising consequences of making it rich quick.
You have the expression DHM, dream house for mom.
Yeah.
And that one of the first things a lot of players do is buy that dream house for mom. And then what happens?
Well, actually, the first thing they do is they buy themselves a fast luxury car, which,
right.
which unfortunately, large numbers of them die in. But the second thing they do, almost without exception, is build a house for their mom. And if, especially these guys who were raised by single mothers who were poor, often in housing projects, who worked, you know, two and three jobs to try and keep the family together and support the kids. When the son makes it to the NFL, it's his opportunity to give back something to his mother. And what I found really interesting was I'd visit these moms living in these small mansions that their sons had built for them, and they were miserable in them. They'd say, you know, I don't need all this space. I don't know why Ben built me this house, you know, or I don't know why Antone bought me such a big house. You'd find them living in the kitchen and in the den in probably the same, roughly the same area of space that they had lived in prior to getting this showcase home, which prompted me to consider, and I actually believe, that what the player is doing when he buys his mom the house is he's trying to grab on to this fantasy of upper middle class life that he never had. And he enshrines his mother in this house on the outskirts of whatever community he grew up in. And it's like capturing the high ground in a way. And the mother is not necessarily well suited for that. And as a result, I think, I found in many of these instances there, they sort of pine for the son because it's the house is really for the son. The house is really for the player.
So the mother has this wonderful house, but how often does she get to see her celebrity son?
Not that much, and particularly when the son meets the Mrs. NFL star. And there's also a lot of animosity then that develops frequently between the mom and the wife. I mean, for instance, if I'm 21, 22 years old and I want to spend $250,000 to build my mom a house or $500,000 to build her a house and put her on a monthly stipend of $5,000 or so, well, that's fine. Until I get married and have a kid or something, and my wife is apt to say to me, does your mother really need, you know, $5,000 a month? Or does she really need this addition on that already oversized house that she has? The family fortune from the mother's point of view is cut in half when the athlete marries, or even less than half. And very frequently, you'll find that there's real competition between the mother and the wife. The other part of that is that the wives tend to come from whole different socioeconomic backgrounds. The player maybe met his wife in college, and she maybe grew up in a upper middle class home. And so the player's mother, who is in a housing project and who has all the mindset and attitudes of a poor person who grew up in a poor black community, I mean, those, I think on both sides, there's a lot of suspicion and distrust and fear. Which creates sometimes really difficult situations for the men to deal with.
My guest is Mark Bowden, author of the new book, Bringing the Heat. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mark Bowden. His new book, Bringing the Heat, is about pro football and the Philadelphia Eagles. You wrote about Wes Hopkins, mm-hmm. and who's married to a woman named Erica, but was having an affair with another woman named Amy.
Mm-hmm.
And his wife, Erica, found out about it. And even all the times when he would tell her it was called off.
He would go back to her. In that sense, it's no different than any other story of a philandering husband and a long-suffering wife. But what makes this particularly interesting to me and unusual was that Wes's philandering was open. And Erica basically had to either put up with it or leave. And it's at that point, at the point where I'm writing about it in 1992, she had decided that she was going to put up with it. But she did have one pathetic request, and that was that he not bring his girlfriend to the football games. Because Erica was for one thing, she was the president of the Association of Eagles Wives, and the football game was a big social event for Erica. She was there with all of her friends, and the idea of Wes's girlfriend being brought to the game, you know, was humiliating for her. She discovered at the Denver Broncos game in 1990 that, in fact, Erica had, or rather, Wes had brought his girlfriend to the game, and she actually stormed down and got in a fight with the woman. And a number of the other Eagles wives came to her assistance, and they all ended up getting hauled off by security and arrested. It made for a very sort of public show in the stands during that game, and it precipitated the breakup of Wes and Erica's marriage. But what I found interesting about it, other than the fact that it made for a good story, is this idea that a number of these young men have, that they are above the rules, the normal rules governing human behavior, so that they have every expectation that their wife is going to allow them to have girlfriends and to appear publicly with their girlfriends.
I know you're interested in how fame and money affects the lives of young men who play football, but what happens when their career ends and there's less fame and there's less money and there's injuries to contend with too?
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know as much about that and didn't write about it that much in the book, although, of course, in the years that I spent covering the team and hanging around the players, I saw a number of players end their careers, and I got to know players who had stopped playing years ago. Some of them handle it really well. Some of them take the money that they've made, and they make that transition very smoothly. Frankly, because most of these guys, again, are not big, big stars. Most of them you never heard of before. You know, all they are guys who made a lot of money doing something that they love to do, and who have a chance maybe then to launch the rest of their life or their career. But I think for a substantial number of them, it all catches up to them when they stop playing football, because a lot of them were big stars in college football, but they didn't get a college education. And a lot of them live that life of celebrity and status while they're a player, and it ends abruptly.
What did you see during your season with the Eagles that surprised you the most?
I'll tell you, one of the things that really surprised me a lot was the intellectual demands of the game. I mean, I had always watched football and admired the athletic ability, but I never really understood how incredibly scripted the game is and how sophisticated its tactics are. I mean, you have 11 players battling against 11 other players. And the coaches, who, as I've already said, spend their lives studying this game, learning it inside out, have every play of the game basically scripted beforehand. You know, for instance, the offensive coach knows that his guys are going to get the ball maybe 8 times over the course of a football game on average. And he has studied with the aid of computer breakdowns of the other team's tendencies what they're likely to do on first down plays, second down plays, third down plays. And if you watch the football game, often you'll see the coach on the sidelines. He's got a laminated sheet of paper or a clipboard. And what he has there are lists of all the first down plays that he intends to call in that game and in the order he intends to call them, all the second down plays, all the third down plays. And he's shopping on that list before every play for which one he wants to use. The players have, over the course of months, and in some cases years, practiced these highly choreographed maneuvers. In slow motion, they'll walk through them on the field, then they'll run them again and again and again. And then they get out there on the field, and they've got to try to execute this play, which, as I said, for every single man is very carefully scripted. And then they've got 11 guys across them who are trying like hell to stop them. And so it makes for, I think, if you understand the level of complexity, a fascinating intellectual exercise once you understand the way the game is played.
I guess this is as good a time as any to confess that I don't follow football, which probably a lot of people figured out from my questions anyways. But I know, like, Sunday afternoons and when all the pregame shows come on, it always seems like, you know, there's just whole programs devoted to strategy sessions where, you know, things are played in slow motion and there's a guy there with a pointer, you know, showing how a play was executed and everything. So I always assumed everybody who's serious about the game is really in on all of this strategy.
Yeah. It's real popular now, although I think the most successful practitioner of the what they call the magic wand that they show you on TV is John Madden, who used to be a professional coach himself, but he's so successful with it because he's funny and he doesn't take it all that seriously. He knows better, I think, than to try to lead the audience into the full arcane description of what was supposed to happen on a given play. And yet on the same hand, I've seen him almost intuitively point out exactly where a play breaks down or why a play succeeds. I think he's far and away the best of the commentators. The kind of breakdowns that you see on TV, you know, are the most primitive analysis, really, of what's going on in the play, because they'll focus on maybe one or two players, which is all they really have time to do, and they're able to show what happened in one isolated part of the field. But I think you'd probably put the audience to sleep if you went into full detail.
You write for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and you've had many different beats in both news and sports.
Mm-hmm.
And you covered football, I guess, for what, 3 years?
3 seasons.
Yeah, so you're not a lifelong sports writer, and, you know, sports is not what drives you.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you get along with the players? Were you a different kind of animal to them?
I got along, I think, better with the players than mm-hmm. most of the sports writers did. I would confess to players right up, you know more about football than I do. You know, I'm asking you these questions because I want to learn. And that approach was really unique to them, because I think most sports reporters set themselves up as experts and as commentators and critics of the game. And my whole approach was different. I wanted, in the same way that I report any story, I wanted to learn as much as I could about these people and this career and this game that they play. And as a result, I think, you know, players were much more willing to talk to me. I would go up to them and say, how many brothers and sisters do you have? As opposed to, how come you dropped that ball in the third quarter on, you know, in Sunday's game? And it wasn't a calculating thing on my part. I was really interested in them as people. And I think they warmed up to that. A lot of the players did. One of the reasons I was able to write this book, I think, is because of the approach I took.
Mark Bowden, he's the author of the new book, Bringing the Heat. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have on former President Carter's attempt to be a mediator in the Balkan War?
Hi, Terry. Andy Bowers reports from Zagreb on Jimmy Carter's day in Bosnia. Mr. Carter has now gone on to Belgrade, the capital of Serbia. Also, we'll have a conversation, William Hyland and Zbigniew Brzezinski talking with Robert Siegel about the Carter diplomacy. John McChesney reports on the decision by the Intel company to replace the faulty Pentium chips without question. John Burnett reports from Texas on Christmas tamales in the city of Brownsville, Texas, and a discussion of where book titles come from and piano music for Christmas in the stride style from Butch Thompson.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A young quintet from Manchester called Oasis is already a huge hit in England, makers of rough but tuneful music that has elicited the inevitable comparisons to the Beatles. Over here, the group is barely known outside of college radio, but rock critic Ken Tucker says the band's debut album is more than hype and deserves a wide audience.
One reason I knew instantly that I liked Oasis was the way singer Liam Gallagher gratuitously distorts the words imagination and situation on that song, Cigarettes and Alcohol. There's no reason to mangle the words this way, but Gallagher is following a noble rock and roll tradition that includes Chuck Berry chilling out in his Coolerator and Elton John moaning, Don't Discard Me. Of course, like any good young band worth its salt, Oasis would probably sneer at these comparisons. What they're after is a distinctly 90s effect, headlong ambivalence. You can hear it in their debut album title, It's called Definitely Maybe. And in the queasy sarcasm, they squirt into Rock and Roll Star. In England, Definitely Maybe went gold in 2 days, and British music papers are full of stories about the frequently acrimonious relationship between Liam Gallagher and his brother, Noel, lead guitarist for the band. They've been known to come to blows on stage. They told the Washington Post that they'd grown up in the 70s, quote, sniffing glue, smoking cigarettes, drinking cider, and listening to the Sex Pistols. They also said, America needs us more than we need them, thus qualifying for the arrogance necessary to be an interesting bunch of snotty upstarts. Fortunately, they also have the music to back it up. On one of the songs here, Liam sings, "You've Gotta Make It Happen," and that's what's immediately appealing about Oasis. They're barreling into rock and roll myth as if no other bunch of peevish 20-year-olds had ever thought of that before. They may take pride in affecting a 90s ambivalence, but their energy and talent already carries a whiff of timelessness.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Definitely Maybe, the debut album from the English group Oasis. I hate ending the show with goodbyes, so I'm glad that I've been spared from saying goodbye to our ace intern, Sienna Chrisman. She's wrapping up the first part of her internship today, but we'll come back to continue that internship next semester. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Forrest Whitaker. In The Crying Game, he played the soldier kidnapped by the IRA. He portrayed Charlie Parker in the film Bird. Now he co-stars in Robert Altman's new movie, Ready to Wear. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.